from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this next hour, tonight the San Francisco International Film Festival presents its Founders Directing Award to three-time Oscar-winning director, screenwriter, and producer Oliver Stone, which puts him in the company of such famed film directors as Akira Kurosawa, Francis Ford Coppola, Werner Herzog, Clint Eastwood, Milos Forman, Arthur Penn, Joseph Mankiewicz, Warren Beatty, and Mike Lee. Oliver Stone will join us in studio for the hour, and we'll have a wide-ranging conversation with him about his life, career, and politics with your calls, emails, and your online postings. Next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Oliver Stone, one of America's most prominent and controversial filmmakers, is being honored this evening in San Francisco at the 54th Annual International Film Festival with the prestigious Founders Directing Award. Previous recipients include such directorial giants as Akira Kurosawa, Francis Ford Coppola, Werner Herzog, Clint Eastwood, Milos Forman, Arthur Penn, Joseph Mankiewicz, Warren Beatty, and Mike Lee. Stone is also a three-time Oscar Award winner for his directing of two war-related films, Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, and his screenplay of the film Midnight Express. He also produced such films as The Joy Luck Club and Reversal of Fortune, and has, in fact, directed some 20 feature films, as well as a number of documentaries. Last night, one of his earlier motion pictures, Salvador, was screened in San Francisco at the Kabuki in recognition of the film's 25th anniversary. Known as much for his leftist politics and controversial outspokenness, including recent highly publicized remarks against Jews in Israel, for which he publicly apologized, Oliver Stone was a child of privilege who left Yale after a year at age 21 to join the infantry and experience combat in the Vietnam War. He was awarded a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. He was, just to add to his bona fides, the screenwriter of the film Scarface with Al Pacino and Conan the Barbarian, which starred our former governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Other Oliver Stone-directed films include films on three U.S. presidents, John Kennedy, Richard Nixon, and George W. Bush, the films Wall Street and its sequel, Natural Born Killers, Heaven and Earth, Talk Radio, The Doors, and Alexander. He also produced The People versus Larry Flint. He joins us for this second hour of Forum. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a major award.
Thank you.
And deserving. When I mentioned for the first time, I said admirer and critic, and we'll get to both through the course of this hour, no doubt.
Yeah, you keep threatening to.
Well, you're good-spirited about it. And I want to get really to your background, first of all, as far as film, because I read with some interest that you had studied with Martin Scorsese at NYU. Interested me because there's a new book out by Richard Schickel about Martin Scorsese, and I thought I'd like to find out from Oliver Stone just how valuable that kind of film education is. There are a lot of young people who listen to this who want to be film majors, want to be you, want to direct films.
It was invaluable. It was a special moment in time. It was right after Vietnam for me, and I was a bit lost, and I went to you could get an education in those days, but and I also got the GI Bill. They paid for my education at NYU, and you know, here you could watch films all day. So it was a great idea. And I stumbled into it, and I loved Marty was one of the first teachers I had, and he was a special energy, high volatility, love of film. In those days, there was no video. He'd stay up all night and watch the old movies on television in New York. So we had quite, you know, volatile sessions, and we made short films, 2-3 minutes, 4 minutes, 16 millimeter. And we had critic sessions, sort of like the Cultural Revolution, where we'd tear each other's films apart. It was quite a learning experience.
It sounds a little apocryphal, but the story is that when you were in Vietnam, you were thinking you would be a writer, a novelist. You wrote a 1,400-page at the time autobiographical novel, which was published later on, about 35 years later, and that story is quite a saga in itself. What I'm struck by in that is the decision to become a filmmaker instead. And you said it had to do with the wetness of the paper in Vietnam.
It's an old story. Yeah, it's a piece of a story. Yeah, I had written a book before I went to Vietnam. I'd gone to Vietnam twice, first as a teacher in a school over there, and then as a merchant sailor. And I came back to the United States, and I wrote this book called Child's Night Dream, which was ran to 1,400 pages and was rejected by the publishers, and I was very upset and broken about it. As you can imagine, I was 19. I went back to Vietnam eventually at 21, and where I enlisted in the infantry, and came back, and 35 years later, practically, 1997, I released the book, went back, cleaned it up, made it presentable, and it was it's called The House I Dreamed About by St. Martin's Press in 97.
That should give hope to many of those closet novelists who are out there.
It's a very intimate book, only a 19-year-old. It's done in a 19-year-old voice, you see. It's not. When I went back at the age of 50, I didn't want to tamper with the voice, and it was very important to preserve the integrity of that 19-year-old.
But was the failure to get it published also part of your decision to go become a filmmaker?
Your question, because in Vietnam, like Norman Mailer and Hemingway and James Jones, I thought it was an interesting, here I am in the infantry front line, that I would, try to remember this stuff. But frankly, it was really hard to remember because it happens very in a blur. And as you know, it's very tough. And it rained all the time in Vietnam, especially the monsoon. So everything got soaked and there was no way you could have notes. So eventually I abandoned the idea and I was just trying to stay alive for those years. You saw Platoon. And then later in the tour, when it got a little bit easier for me as a soldier, I bought a little camera and I started taking a lot of pictures. And I noticed that I really like the visual, the viscerality of the visual, because it was getting tremendous jungles and hard scenes, but they were beautiful at the same time. So that my interest in photography grew.
You must have remembered, maybe even if it was just your unconscious, a good deal of what you went through in Vietnam. Otherwise, you couldn't have probably produced a film like Platoon. And in fact, it is to film probably what The Naked and the Dead was to World War II.
In its way, it's a very up-close, intimate memoir for me.
And then the film career took off, really, didn't it? And because of Vietnam in many respects,
Well, I had spurts and starts. I had tremendous success with Midnight Express in 1979, and Scarface, it wasn't huge success, but it was certainly a big movie in 82, Conan the Barbarian. And I was up and down. I did a short film called The Hand with Michael Caine, which disappeared, but was my first directing effort. By the time I got to Platoon in 86, I had done Salvador in 85, and that was also a success to steam call it. And it was played last night at the festival with Jimmy Woods. It had an Oscar nomination for writing and acting. I was the co-writer with Richard Boyle, who's actually a San Francisco journalist.
Yeah, I know Richard.
You know Richard.
Absolutely.
He's a character.
Yeah, he is indeed. Talking to Oliver Stone, and he's being honored this evening by the International Film Festival. You've been, called, lots of things, but an ideologue through the years. And you've said publicly you separate the drama in the film from politics.
Absolutely. You have to. First of all, I'm a dramatist. This is what, this is where my success comes in this, as I write, direct, dramatize these movies. And so when I'm called on as a celebrity or whatever, as a private citizen to speak, I don't want to be one of those people who's muffled by this system, who says, I can't, here I am, I'm a private citizen still, as well as a dramatist, and I have a right to speak, and I think you're an idiot if you don't speak out, and it's the Greek idea of being part of the public discourse, as you are. So when I am called upon, I say what I think. And it's gotten me in a lot of hot water, but unfortunately people blend the two, and they see the dramatist as a political ideologue. So. I'll put it this way, Michael. I sat down to write a movie about Nixon, another movie about George W. Bush. These are people that I don't admire, but I think they're both fair movies. I think they're very empathetic to them and compassionate. People, in fact, criticized me the other way and said that I was too compassionate or empathetic to Bush.
You did get that criticism, but you also got criticism for being kind of, I think you've even used the word, a conspiracy nut. I remember talking to Ed Doctorow about, he said, boy, I have Oliver Stone to blame for all these things that I brought into novels in the way of history. In other words, people were very angry about JFK. They were saying, what's he suggesting, that LBJ was behind the Kennedy assassination, those kinds of things?
No, that's not in the – see the movie again. LBJ is named – is not part of a conspiracy to murder the Kennedy. I don't know who killed Kennedy. I have a good idea. And we suggest shadow areas of covert intelligence in the country. And that movie was based on a hell of a lot of research. I mean, I talked to more people in Dealey Plaza than probably some of the people on the Warren Commission.
And maybe even Mark Lane, huh?
Mark Lane did a lot of good work at the very beginning of this thing, and he was like Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. He was attacked and attacked and attacked. And I was too, frankly. I was another generation, but it really shocked me. I was naive about some of the concepts of how this country is run.
Well, you did something really quite memorable in terms of sort of opening up in the Senate testimony. You gave some of those unclassified documents, which I think people are grateful for.
you know, I mean, listen, it was also a movie that was dramatically fascinating because it was done in a new style that hadn't been done. We were attacking this huge issue in a three-hour-plus movie where we had four different storylines going, and the cutting, the editing, the way of the photography had never quite been done before in a movie. So, you know, that sometimes as a movie it's overlooked.
I want to talk about your film work, of course, but let's talk about some of the citizen remarks that you alluded to before. And you've said, for example, nationalism and patriotism are the two great evils and evil forces that need to be combated. And yet there are those who point out, Ron Radish recently said, I think, that you've been nothing short of an apologist, is the way he put it, for Chavez and Castro and now Ahmadinejad. So the idea is somehow that these nationalists are patriotic dictators are somehow maybe scot-free from that kind of condemnation of patriotism and nationalism.
Whoa. I mean, that's a huge – I don't know where this gentleman comes up with that idea. First of all, I never said anything about Ahmadinejad, pro or con. I was asked to do an interview with him by the government, and I didn't do it because of timing. But I never made a comment on it. I've tried to always understand the other person's position. Chavez is not a dictator, and I've made that point in South of the Border. And whatever all this easy kind of invective that's hurled at him, I think you have to check the facts on the ground. And I went there, I talked to them, and we show it in the film. I mean, there's no point going hashing over these old remarks, but there's very much the American media against the new left in South America. America is the oppressor in South America and has been for more than a century. So it's an old story. Castro is part of that story, but Castro is a different political leader than Chavez. And I have defended the right of Castro to speak and to be heard because we are the giant pressing on Cuba, and we treat Cuba as if it's China right in our backyard. But our human rights in our country are also questionable.
But you would concede that human rights have been violated in both Cuba and Venezuela.
Yeah, but I would go... In Venezuela, you have to be very careful about this because there's been erroneous reports. And, you have to go into a specific case by case. There are judges that violate things. But Chavez's policy has been anti-terrorist and pro-democracy. He's been elected three times.
Shut down the TV stations, didn't he?
No, one television station was shut down for calling for the overthrow of the government. It would happen in this country, too, Mike. And if I said on the air that we got to, some of the hate speech that we've heard would have been shut down and the licensing would shut down. And it wasn't, Chavez is enforcing the law like our FCC laws.
You see him as a democratic leader, not as a dictator.
I do. I think that if tomorrow he lost and he will lose eventually, he would leave. Absolutely.
You've also said, though, in Iran we don't have the full story. We don't know the full story.
No, we don't.
And we have a horrible attitude toward Iran.
Well, we have to start with 1950,
go back to Mousavi and the overthrow.
Yeah, we have to. You have to get the story from the beginning because every story has a cause and effect through time.
But when you look at the mullahs today ruling that country, you look at people in the Green Revolution being shot down, it doesn't give you pain?
Yes, it does. Of course it does. Oppression everywhere does. People are victimized, yes. But can we look at Bradley Manning here? Can we start to look at some of the people who are in jail in Guantanamo?
And we do.
Who don't belong
We do
there?
On this program, of course, understandably so. Talk about the comments that really probably caused the biggest uproar recently that you made. I want to get you on record on this and get your interpretation. A lot of people saw it as, it was called rank bigotry. You were even compared to Mel Gibson, of all people. We should mention, I think your father was Jewish. His name was Silverstein before it was changed to Stone. So some of these charges seem, perhaps unfounded. But let's talk about what you did say. And obviously you've worked with Jewish people your whole life. Hollywood could hardly avoid that. But the idea that somehow Israeli policy has shaped essentially American attitudes toward the Middle East. No one would deny that. And that AIPAC is an extraordinarily powerful lobby, maybe next to the NRA, the most powerful lobby. But the idea that somehow Jews are sort of dictating the focus on the Holocaust was what people, I think, took real exception to in the comments. And also the idea that somehow you were saying that the number of Russians who were killed by Hitler exceeded the number of Jews who were killed. So therefore, it's worse what was done to the Russians.
My remarks were made in London to a reporter who was let's leave the reporter out. But anyway, I apologize for the comments. I think they were out of context. I was talking about the untold history of the United States, which I'm very passionate about. It's a 10 to 12-hour documentary I've been working on for 3-plus years.
This is one that Showtime
is coming up with it later in actually, it's going to come out now in probably in January or February of next year.
Well, there's no attempt to influence them not to have it on, is there not?
Oh, no, not at all. No, of course, there is by some
Ari Emanuel,
usual crackpots. And, yeah. But I'm not, well, that's, I'm not going to go there because, you don't win when you get into the bath with all the hatred and the people who would like to cut the free speech, cut the ability to express ourselves. The history is very serious, and it's done with a historian. Peter Kuznick is my co-writer, and he's the expert on professor of nuclear studies at American University. I've been working with him for years. It's factual. We based it on a lot of forgotten history stuff. We're taking the history that we learned in school, which we think brainwashes the kids about America, and we're taking the same facts and we're putting them into different patterns so that our young people could see that our history is not what we make it out to be.
Can you give me a singular example?
Well, we can start with the bombing at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I don't want to give away what we're doing, but we start there and we go after the concept that we needed to drop the bomb in with facts. And that starts the whole thing about the national security state and who started the Cold War, who did what to who. We conveniently blame the Russians for everything, and I think that it's a very dangerous situation. We go into the Russian contribution to World War II extensively to show to people who don't know anything about it, who in fact took out most of the German military.
And you, in fact, go into American complicity with the Nazis, including some of the corporate people.
There was definitely a factual complicity. We were very careful in what we're saying because we realize that there's been a tremendous amount of, counter lawsuits from all these corporations to bury the past. But, memory is the thread of our civilization. Without memory, we're going to resort to barbarism. And already, I think we've lost much of the memory of World War II, what it was. It's pictured sentimentally in movies as the good war. They make 50-100 movies about World War II. They make a lot of money off it. But, there's a tremendous amount of suffering went on in World War I and World War II. And by the way, we go back to World War I, too, which is the mother of the war, of all wars. How this last century got distorted and how America emerged as the central empire of this new world and what it did with that power over those next 70 years after World War II.
Talking with Oliver Stone, again being honored this evening by the International Film Festival, the San Francisco International Film Festival. At one point in your career, you said, getting back to your filmmaking, Buñuel and Godard, major influences, maybe the two most major influences. That still holds up?
That was a spontaneous remark off of Salvador, I think I made it. Yeah, there were two great influences. They're not the only ones, but certainly yes. I was very French-oriented or in Spanish. But then, I discovered American cinema over these years, too. And you have to say, there's so many great movies that are...
Well, you called Citizen Kane, I think, the best movie ever made, or one of the best movies.
I don't go into the best list. I mean, honestly, I could sit there now and watch the last 150 years of movies over again and enjoy it. No, 110 years. And enjoy the movies because they're so good. And movies like that hold up. It's like the Renaissance painting. It's, this thing happened for 100 years now, and it's just an amazing... So many great movies that were made and they're neglected.
You go back and see your own films, and if so, do you feel critical about them?
No, I do. I have to. I mean, sometimes it's not easy, but I'd love to because it is self-critique, and you get better sometimes from watching your mistakes.
Well, you said, in fact, some things about the movie Alexander, which was really a great love and passion of yours, and the film that you probably have suffered more over because of its not doing as well as you had hoped. And you said, I think at one point, if you had it to do again, you would do it like Once Upon a Time in America.
I said more than that. Actually, I went back and did something about it. It did bother me. I felt that the film was not ready. I pushed it because we had a contract to deliver in November 2004. The movie came out under 3 hours as contracted, but it was never a less than 3-hour movie because the man's life is extraordinary. And I'd written a script that was really a 3-hour, 45-minute movie, which it was. I tried to jam it, squeeze it, cut it, dice it, put it into a box. It didn't fit. And, of course, with Warner Bros. United States, we had to cut the violence a lot, and we also had to cut the sexuality, which involved a homosexual affair as well as an affair with a third gender, a transsexual affair. Alexander was an extraordinary man. He was explorer beyond belief, inwardly and outwardly. Parents, foreign lands, a proto figure, before pre-Christian figure, that, you know, you can't compare by the standards of in those days. When the film came out, they criticized him for being George W. Bush, who went into Baghdad. It was like ridiculous because the comparison is a faulty one. So I went back in 2007, and available is this 3-hour, 45-minute, two-part version, and it should be a two-part road movie like you used to see when you were a kid, with that intermission, because you need the time to stop in the middle of this journey and think about it and ingest it and then go back. And they don't make those movies anymore. But I got it out on Blu-ray, and they're showing it at the Museum of Moving Image a month ago, and they're showing it at Lincoln Center in their new theater in June 10th, I think it's going to be, as well as in Taormina in Sicily on that weekend, too. I'm going to fly to both places.
I was fascinated with the fact that you were so fascinated with Alexander, because it made me think about Freud's fascination with Hannibal. I think, you know, there may be some analogies there.
I think Alexander is a protean figure because he carried with him a mobile empire. He brought scientists, architects. He literally united, and in his wake, whatever people say, and you can quibble, and there was a lot of, you know, there were negative things, but was peace, prosperity, economic union, and an empire that really came together with roads, commerce, and a new kind of cultural context where Greek, Indian, and Egyptian, the cultures were merging in a new kind of way that had not existed prior to that. It was a great achievement, and the Roman Empire took that achievement and, frankly, militarized it into something else. But essentially, Alexander's empire was a great model at the dawn of our recorded history.
What was more disappointing, that film not reaching the success you'd hoped for, or not getting published, that early autobiographical novel?
I never thought of it that way, but they were both huge setbacks at their time, yes. But the Alexander one, I went back. You're right, I did the book too. 30 years later, I did the book, and 3 years later, I did the Alexander. But, you know, when I sit there with an audience and see Alexander now, that it's really... And the audience, you cry at this movie because it's a life journey, this man. And it's the biggest movie ever made, the most ambitious.
You want audiences to cry? You certainly want to get to them emotionally.
Yes. Yeah, a movie, as I said, is that you're a dramatist. You want people to feel.
I felt a lot after seeing Natural Born Killers. But what I felt was, I said I was a critic of yours. I felt he's trying to, well, they said you were fetishizing violence. I felt, here's Oliver Stone showing us how corrupt we are and how we have this mania about violence, how obsessed our American culture is with violence, at the same time that you were using it, really. I mean, you were doing, in effect, paradoxically, what you were kind of indicting.
Well, I don't know how a dramatist can do that. You can talk about violence, but you can have scenes about a trial of Eichmann and talk about the violence. I suppose I could do it that way. But this was a movie that was a full-on indictment of what I was seeing on television in the 1990s, and I thought it was over for us. It only got worse. I was right, prophetic, in the sense that the media is fragmenting completely. But here was the O.J. Simpson trial on television for money reasons, day in, day out, day in, day out. They're selling that the same way they're selling Donald Trump with his silly... You know, you take the silliest event, the gossip event, and you make it into a moneymaker.
Well, it wasn't only television. There was a radio station. It was all O.J. 24 hours.
Yeah, and then there was, if you remember at that time, it jumped up to a quantum level. There was a woman who cut off a man's penis. There was an ice skater.
Lorena Bobbitt.
And it was all front page news all of a sudden. It was what had been once tabloid news was now the news, because the news was stripped of its public license in the 1980s at CBS by Whit Tisch, who said, the news division is now up for profit. It has to make a profit.
Hold that thought. That's Oliver Stone, citizen, not necessarily Oliver Stone, dramatist. I want to give out the phone number and invite those of you listening to join us. You're cordially invited to participate. And if you'd like to talk to Oliver Stone, if you have a question or comment, please feel free to call us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum at kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit.
That, of course, is Michael Douglas in Oliver Stone's film Wall Street. Sounds like Ivan Boesky, but it's Gordon Gekko. Did you ever imagine that you would create all these kind of little geckos as a result of that? People who Well, saw him as a role model and wanted to pattern their lives after him?
No, not to the degree that most of the films you don't see that coming. Like JFK, same thing. You know, it's a pebble in the pond and then all of a sudden it has impact. But so many young people told me when I went back to the second version that they had come to Wall Street. They were doing something else, like engineering or lawyer, wanted to be a lawyer. And then they saw the movie and they came to Wall Street. I guess money attracts the flies, you know.
Well, and Inside Job came out around the same time. There were strange comparisons because that was a documentary. Yours was, of course, a drama. I'm talking about the sequel to Wall Street. And Charlie Ferguson kind of nailed it, didn't he? We had him on this program after he won the Academy Award. Didn't you think it was really—
I thought it was an excellent movie. I think it's a documentary. You know, it wasn't what we were doing. We were trying to make a drama that would— I think we captured, too, the sense that this whole thing is coming to an unsatisfactory ending in that everyone's getting off scot-free. In our movie, life goes on. You know, it's a big deal. People get hurt, but the Wall Street crowd, for the most part, gets away with it.
You want to be there in your film, sort of on the cusp of history, don't you? You want to capture those moments.
Yes. Well, for me, you have to realize I'm going back to Wall Street after 21 years. My dad was a Wall Street broker. This is important because I saw the beginning of that surge when it really got crazy. The Reagan era had kicked in. These people were really hungry. They were a relic of what I saw in Miami with the Scarface people, the drug dealers. They were up on Wall Street now, but instead of coke, they were pushing stocks and bonds, and they were making big money with hostile takeovers and kind of phony financial manipulation. It reached, when I went back in 2008 and I talked to Elliot Spitzer, these people, I was shocked by the jadedness of it. You see, now the money was so enormous that we were talking about billions instead of millions. I felt it was the end of something that was, we'd reached a jaded point where satiated is the word, and I think the movie reflects the end of that, I hope.
You mentioned your dad, and there's been a lot of psychobiographical— well, you've been in analysis three times, I understand. Is that right?
You know a lot about me.
Well, and in fact, I know that you did LSD in some of those analysis sessions, which I find kind of fascinating. But what I find even more interesting, I think three times is maybe even more than Woody Allen has put in terms of overall hours. Has it been useful? Has it been valuable?
Very. No, I did this on a limited basis. I went with a psychiatrist. Each one was picked and chosen by expert people who advised me. And each one had a tremendous contribution to make to my life. But I felt like after a year or so that I'd reached a place where I didn't want to repeat what we were doing. I know what was happening emotionally, the buttons that were, and I felt like I could help myself. Woody, whatever his problem, does seem to need to make it a habit, you see. I didn't want to make it a habit because I think I don't want to be addicted to anything in my life, including grass or psychiatrists.
Or any other substances could we include,
no,
too?
Because they're all gone now.
You had the coke stuff for a while.
That was horrible. That was the worst. That was during the Scarface, pre-Scarface period, yeah.
It was almost like research for Scarface, too.
I was so angry with myself and disappointed with myself that I actually wrote the actual script. I did stone cold sober. And I said, I'm going to get my revenge on this drug because it's stolen so much of my life. And by making the movie, I think it was a form of exorcism.
I think it was Bruce J. Friedman who said, I never thought I could like anything more than sex with women, but cocaine did it for me. Is that true for you?
God, it was awful. An awful drug. But what's worse is it just takes away your intelligence gradually and you don't even see it. And before you know it, your brain cells are affected.
Well, you've done pretty well in spite of it as far as the brain cells.
Your brain has the ability to grow back, and I did go to one of the psychiatrists led me to a drug at that time in the 1980s. It does grow back brain matter.
Your mother was French. As you said, your father was a stockbroker and, in fact, a Republican, anti-Castro. Some people like to say, but boy, he had this sexy mother that he was maybe in love with, and his father was kind of dominant, and he went off to the infantry and said, the hell with Yale, I'm going to show my combat prowess and all that kind of stuff, that it becomes an Oedipal drama, your own life.
Sure, there's a lot of that, too. Of course.
You buy that, though?
I buy Greek myth, absolutely. I did Alexander for that reason. There's a lot of my stories in Alexander, too. But by the way, my mother was strong, too. It's not like my father was the strong one. My father was very strong. My mom was very strong. I was lucky to have two strong parents, but it's hard to grow up sometimes between the two of them.
Your mother's still in Palm Springs?
She's still going. I saw her last Easter
weekend. She's, in her 80s.
She's 89, Hey, Mom.
I hope she's listening. There was that sense, though, that you had a kind of, a privileged boyhood, but a sad boyhood in many ways. The boarding schools and the parents going through a divorce and stuff that comes out as being a lonely kind of isolated kid who went through some real maybe trauma.
Very. I was an only child, yes. It scarred me for life, but I've, through psychiatry and various and my life experience, I've learned to be step outside, detach from the pains that you have. Every child goes through this, and it was, you know, going to boarding school at 14 and when your parents are divorcing is, and in a three-person family is like the end of a family. You understand? It's not. I was on my own essentially at 14.
Let me bring some of our callers in. We'll go first to you, Matt. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How's it going?
Hi, Matt. Good. Beautiful day here in San Francisco.
I was just curious regarding Natural Born Killers. It was a movie that really had a big impact on me, and I saw it when I was pretty young. And I probably didn't get it until I was older. But I was just curious about some of your stylistic choices, the inclusion of animation, and just the cinematography in general, and kind of what impact you were going for with it.
You know, at the time, it was 93. It took a year to edit that movie. We really cut it. We cut it in a new kind of style with 3-4 editors. It was just throwing up everything I knew, just regurgitating feelings of hostility and vomit and madness. And, you know, the culture that those kids grow up in, Mickey and Mallory, and I think the saving grace of the movie, perhaps Michael missed it, is that they loved each other. And those people who really dug the movie like that.
No, part I did of it. Miss that.
But the people said to me, you know, how can they get away with it? How can they love each other? But that was they only had each other. They were two alike animals in a society, as you can see, that was extremely shown in an exaggerated, corrupt way. Rodney Dangerfield's a sick father. They live in a sitcom type atmosphere. Mickey has got no. His father is a monster. You know, it's white trash, and if there is in America, if you go out to with the U-turn country where I did that movie, it's just you'll see this whole. We live in suburbs and gated communities that are really, and trash houses, and if there's no culture, there's no food. You're eating a Jack in the Box, and you suffer.
I think you once said maybe we need McDonald's food to feed the world. Didn't you say something?
I did say that. I did, and it's funny you remember that. That's amazing. But I did. I said this was 1986, and I. And I said something to the effect that with McDonald's, we won't have wars. And I've lived to eat my words because we did have wars and we did have more McDonald's.
Well, it's a Tom Friedman notion, too. For a while, he said, you know, countries that have McDonald's don't necessarily.
That's right. Yeah. Anyway. That's my father's side coming out.
Still there in you. Huh? It resides. Yeah. Let me go to more of our callers. Timothy, you're next. Hi. Welcome to the program.
Yes, Mr. Stone, getting to the Alexander topic again. Do you think, as you look back on your research of Alexander, that his approach to Persia in merging the Greek civilization with the Persian civilization, having his top officer staff intermarry with Persian women, not to destroy what was there, but to build upon it, add the best of Greek culture on it, civilization on it, is the approach we should take toward Iran today? Do you think that that approach, the merging approach, rather than Hillary Clinton's approach when she was campaigning, said if Iran makes any move toward Israel, we will obliterate Iran? Do you think that's the wrong approach? The Alexander approach is the more appropriate approach?
Very good question, and I do agree that Hillary Clinton's diplomacy is very ethnocentric American and it's American power, its projection of American power in the world. I really think Alexander was a brilliant conqueror, if you would. He'd go into the country and he would stay, and he would grant them as much autonomy as possible, as long as they behaved in a trustworthy way with him and they didn't rebel behind his back, and if they did, he would go back and he'd crush them. And he was very ruthless that way about Thebes, and he did it several times in the northwest Persia. But it's a great story because he did merge, and he stayed. Unlike George W. Bush, who went to Baghdad, he said, "We're not going to get into building up a nation policy." He did build. He did build together, and he left his soldiers who were wounded, the veterans behind in these 1819 Alexandrias he built. He intermarried. He married himself two Persians and a Bactrian, amazing story, and he never went back to Macedonia. That's why he was killed, I think. I got into that whole theory at the end of the movie, because he wouldn't rest. He wouldn't stop. He was going on to Saudi Arabia. His generals had reached this place where they had a lot of power, a lot of money, and they're in their 40 years old. They want to live with it. They want to rest. They don't want to go on with Alexander into another crazy adventure. So there was a real motive to get rid of him and Hephaestion, because they're very dangerous to go on. They want to get the money. They want to split the empire. They did into four parts. It's an amazing story.
Let me thank the caller. More on Alexander in a moment. Email that I think you'll like from a listener. But didn't you once call marriage a cultural defect? Is that something
I said that?
I think you did, yeah.
I did say it was an economic, it was originally the Christian version of it. Most people didn't get married. I mean, am I right? In world history, most people who were poor never got married. It was a bourgeois concept.
There's a whole wonderful book by a feminist scholar at Stanford, Marilyn Yellum, about the whole history of marriage. Actually, maybe a good topic for you.
But I mean, Alexander got married to three people. I mean, I think you should be allowed to marry.
Be like the Mormons?
I don't know about the Mormon religion. I can just say that there's a concept of where, when you travel through life, to be able to marry with those you love. And some people would say monogamy is the only way to love. That's a good question. It's another show, though, another radio show.
It is another show. No, it can be taken up on anything's taken up. Anything's marketable, so to speak, or doable as far as radio goes. Tim says, I would like to give Oliver Stone my thanks for making the movie Alexander, though I constantly encounter scorn for my love of this movie. The truth is, it changed my life. I realize it has many flaws, but what showed through for me was a cogent story that made a real history, an ancient history, that had a huge effect on history after that point, come alive. It showed a society where same-love sex was integral to life, which even in our modern times we have yet to achieve. It brought to light a very flawed but very courageous figure in a way that moved me beyond tears. To this day, I cannot fully articulate it to the naysayers, but my wholehearted thanks for moving me so. Doesn't get much better than that, does it?
No, thank you, Timothy. There's quite a lot of people have seen this movie, and but a lot of them don't even know about this new version. I don't know if Timothy has seen Alexander Revisited, which is available on Amazon and through Warner Brothers, iTunes and stuff like that. But it's also a different movie. It's a different structure. When you put this movie into a new structure like this with two acts, it makes it a whole different feeling. It's even more powerful, in my opinion.
Another listener, this may amuse you, Bruce from Oakland, says, I was one of the 2,000 extras for the San Francisco concert scene in the Doors movie. Two memorable nights hanging out with friends and dancing to the same short clip of music. I also got a $115 check for my time. Thank you.
That was a lot of money then, no? No, I think everyone had the extras were incredible in that movie. They would come, and I think the assistant director would say, well, okay, we need people to peel off their shirts. And it was all of a sudden we needed like 10 people, but all of a sudden like 100 people would peel off their tops, and women would be dancing on the shoulders of men.
Well, that was the Woodstock era, wasn't it?
This was 1990 when this
happened. I mean, the new Woodstock era.
But there was there was this hunger, actually, to go back into that.
Well, there were two Woodstocks. There was one that came, that was what I was thinking, when it came later. What was the fascination for you with Jim Morrison? I mean, was it mainly his charisma, his music?
His poetry and his music was incredible, but the poetry, the lines, the lyrics, he was one of those few people in that era who's actually was, everything he said was very clear, because he was, and Arthur Rimbaud was his, and Baudelaire, Apollinaire were some of his heroes, and he wanted to, and Edgar Allan Poe, he wanted to communicate, and that's what comes through, and I followed his songs from the beginning to the end. I think he grew as an artist. I'm against the concept that, yeah, he gets fat, and he drugged out, and he does have the downslide physically, but mentally, he's very acute at the end, and the American Prayer album, which is one of the most extraordinary works of poetry he did alone.
He's also, you mentioned France and Baudelaire and Rimbaud, he's beyond a cult hero in France. I mean, people go regularly to his grave almost like they do to Graceland.
I would see that. I can see that. I can see him lasting through time. He died young, and he was beautiful at one point. He fits all
You ever see the video of that song, Touch Me? I'm sure you have. There's just something about that video that's so magnetic and compelling when he was young and, like you say, beautiful looking.
Mm-hmm.
I have so admired, Jolaine writes, Mr. Stone's work. Would he care to comment on his Women in Love movie after the D.H. Lawrence novel? I loved it and would like to know about his inspiration and drive to make it. I don't think you didn't make Women in Love, did you?
No, and I
read a lot of movies, but not that much.
I read D.H. Lawrence. Also, he was a very beautiful writer, gushing, and he reached a level of consciousness with sex that was unbelievable to me. And
especially for its time.
Yeah. And Ken Russell did that. And
that's
he did
right. It was
wonderful
Ken
job.
Russell.
Wonderful job.
Do you believe in, speaking about D.H. Lawrence, do you believe in that kind of Blunderbruderstadt was the word, you know, that sort of fraternal feeling? I mean, coming out of the military and being in combat, there's a sense of a bond between men that is nothing like what they can get with women.
There's definitely that. And where is a bond between when you go through death experiences with people? Even you'd have a bond with a doctor in a hospital. I mean, there is a strong bond, you know, or a nurse. Or it's all about feeling your life. But, you know, the Henry Miller, I mean, also influenced me when I came back from Vietnam. I never heard of this guy, and he was like writing, like, as you know, for pages. I don't think it's great writing, but he certainly poured his heart out.
Do you like the Vietnam writing? Like, you read Tim O'Brien and Philip Caputo, those writers?
Yeah, they're both much of the writing is great. They're both very good, and you know, there's been so many books on Vietnam. I did leave that behind in my head a little bit because I was trying to make Pinkville last year or 2 years ago, the story of My Lai Massacre, and I got dry docked on that one. I was about 3 weeks from shooting. I had the village built. I had the cast done, and then the money fell out during the Wall Street crisis. Mm.
Another listener, Guillermo, says, I'm a huge Oliver Stone fan and would like to ask what future projects he has in the works. Also, if he's ever considered doing a film on the Latin drug cartels, specifically the Mexican ones, sounds like an ideal topic for Mr. Stone to expose. Well, you're working on Savages now, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I think the answer to that is yes. I'm very interested in contemporary Southern California drug culture. I bought this book a year ago called Savages by Don Winslow. It's excellent, good read. And he goes into a story he's made up, but it's a great story about these young independent pot growers and dealers in Southern California who all of a sudden are asked to partner with the Mexican cartel.
What's the status of that film now?
We're starting on July 6th to shoot with a wonderful cast, young cast. Blake Lively is the central young girl, and Aaron Johnson and Taylor Kitsch are her two men. She's like a Butch Cassidy. It's a Butch Cassidy Sundance Kid kind of
or
movie.
Or Jules and Jim.
Yes, exactly.
Truffaut. On to more of your calls, and we go to Central Illinois and welcome Bill. Bill, you're on.
Yeah, hi. As a combat veteran from Vietnam, I was just wondering whether Oliver still has a lot of lingering after effects from his Vietnam experience. As a public school teacher, students would occasionally ask me if I'd ever killed someone, and I tell them that that's really a kind of a rude question to ask, and I wouldn't answer. How does Oliver Stone feel about that? And I'll go ahead and take any answers off the air.
Okay. You did once speak about killing somebody. You've spoken publicly about that.
Yes, I think I did, and I wrote about it in The Child's Night Dream. And also, but I wrote that before the war. After the war, I talked about it a couple of times. I think it is a rude question. I think it's something that's like your religious, spiritual life. You know, it's your personal thing. It's up to you to discuss it. I did discuss it because it helped me exercise those feelings. You have to think about it. You have to think about the people.
You've also said publicly you're a Buddhist, I think, haven't you?
I'm studying Buddhism for 20 years now. Yeah, 20 years.
And you were an Obama supporter. How do you feel about him now?
I think disappointed about many things, such as Guantanamo and Bradley Manning, as I said earlier, and disappointed by the lack of change in our foreign policy. I don't know that there's any benefit for him to do that, to make any changes. I think that right now he's trying to get reelected, and he said he was going to go down with one term if he had to, but he changed his mind.
Bring on more calls, and Joan, you're our next caller. In fact, you want to talk about Bradley Manning. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning to both of you. I was already listening attentively when you mentioned, Mr. Stone, that indeed in this country, if there was a call for violent overthrow of the government, they'd shut the stations down. But then my ears really perked up when you mentioned Bradley Manning, and you just now mentioned your disappointment in our president over the treatment. I'd like to hear, I rarely hear anyone speak of him. I've heard Daniel Ellsberg say a few words. I'd like to know if you'd like to say a bit more, and will we ever have a chance to see that helicopter shooting footage in which the two reporters were shot on national television.
I don't think so. I think our system, the media, is it's a corporate empire, and it's very difficult to get stuff through. I think the WikiLeaks and the alternate media have really done an enormous job of keeping the valve open, but it's a small valve. Manning is being abused. I mean, we have to presume the innocence of every single person who's on trial in this country, and the way he's being abused and driven to suicide, and not with the lights, the nudity, the stories that came out from the lawyers, and the way he's been treated is despicable. But it's in keeping, unfortunately, with the George Bush administration, which started this policy of torture overseas, and the Guantanamo story is shameful.
It's almost like Abu Ghraib in some ways, isn't it?
It is. It's just a continuation of this cruelty, cruel and unusual punishment, but it's also a continuation in my mind of our system of abuse. We next to, I think, China and Russia, we're one of the largest prison populations in the world, like 2 million plus. We put people in jail for life for victimless crimes like drugs, like pot growing. We punish. We have a system of morality and punishment in this country that's beyond the Eighth Amendment. It's just, it's cruel. It's beyond cruel.
You must have been disappointed then when President Obama said about Bradley Manning essentially.
Yeah, I was shocked that he just dismissed it. You know, I mean, I really lost a lot of, lost respect for him. I just don't understand how a constitutional lawyer could, they're clearly breaking the law. You cannot torture people before they come to trial. Yeah, I'm sure he did it. I'm sure he did it for his reasons. And Ellsberg is brilliant in his defense. Ellsberg, by the way, released papers that were far more dangerous. They were called top secret. Mm-hmm. But Manning released papers that were called secret. And Manning is being treated by the press as if he's a despicable person. Although I think the WikiLeaks has been a tremendous boon. It may have hurt some diplomats, but no one's been killed, and there's been no, it hasn't been this huge scandal that the newspapers are predicting. If this truth got out there, I think it's necessary.
Don't you think it put people's lives at risk, though?
It didn't, apparently.
I mean, at this point, one could say that it didn't.
It caused good things to happen in the Middle East. It caused good things. Unfortunately, it did not cause good things to happen in Guantanamo. We're still locking down there.
And again, President Obama seems to feel, at least from what he said publicly, that, Guantanamo's necessary. At least at this point, that's what we can presume and deduce from what he said.
If WikiLeaks had been around in 2003, we would not have gone into the Iraq because the scandal of WikiLeaks would have woken up the media, and that we can't get away with this nonsense of making these declarations. From state policy is very dangerous in this world, and the United States policy is extremely dangerous. We're the homicidal nation.
Of course, there are those who say there's Oliver Stone again, America bashing and all that.
No, I love my country. And I've served it, and I want it to be better, and I think it can be, and it has been.
Do you think, for example, speaking about America bashing, though, you know, I was reading something about your saying nice things about Charlton Heston, who is probably the farthest.
I'm a dramatist. I love people.
Well, but he's also the farthest politically from you.
I worked with him because he said, Charlton Heston went out publicly, and I read a quote somewhere. He said, people like Oliver Stone would never cast me because he had not been working a lot in the 90s because of his statements. So I cast him as the football commissioner in Any Given Sunday. And frankly, I enjoyed the man. I respected him because he's an icon in movies to me. Moses, I grew up with. And, you know, I love Charlton Heston. And, you know, we talked a few politics, but we didn't clash. We didn't talk about the NRA or anything like that. But I'll never forget his nobility because he was suffering greatly at the end of his life with arthritis.
Greatly. A lot of pain, yeah.
And he stood there like Moses in the movie, and he was just going through take after take and kept his dignity.
That's why I wanted to ask you, though, about, you know, because the other one who's always accused, the other filmmaker who's often accused of being anti-American is Michael Moore. And Michael Moore kind of ambushed Charlton Heston. Do you remember that scene?
Yes, I do.
Did you find that, good, bad, indifferent?
It was dramatic. It was certainly dramatic, and it was at the end of his movie. What was the one? Which movie was it?
Bowling for Columbine.
That's right. Yeah, it certainly did give it a good ending. I suppose as a dramatist, you want to steal. Well, he's a
whatever you can use.
I think you have to. I don't know. I have to re-examine the movie. I haven't thought about it.
Where would you draw the line as far as what would be transgressive to you or not usable or going over the line?
Try to be human, try to stay fair. I don't know if I would have done that, but certainly I've been in Palestine, Israel. I did the persona non grata. I remember I was very fair to Netanyahu. You can see it in the film, and there was praise. The film was praised for being fair to both sides.
You see a cover story in the New York Times today? It looks like Hamas and Fatah have made peace and reconciled.
Yeah. I'm not. I haven't been back to talk to these. I talked to both organizations at the time. Actually, I interviewed a bunch of the Al-Aqsa Brigade in the early stages of their. I was in Ramallah right when the Israelis moved in, so I got out right before. But I interviewed the Al-Aqsa people with the masks on there. Interesting bit in the movie if you see it. Persona non grata.
Bring another caller on, and that's you, Dave. Join us quickly,
hello.
Please. Yes. Hi.
Yeah. Hi. My question for Mr. Stone is: I'm a first-time feature filmmaker. I've been in production for over 25 years, and a project came to me that took my heart. And I am now working with the San Francisco Film Society, actually, who puts on the San Francisco Film Festival, and they're the fiscal sponsor of the film. And sort of in the development phase of them, we've done a lot of shooting, but we're out trying to raise funding, and it is very difficult and frustrating, and I'm feeling like I'm getting pulled in all sorts of directions from people who are all with all good intentions, but as a sort of like the one-man submarine here, until we can get the funding we need, I wonder if Mr. Stone had any advice for first-time filmmakers that are doing films that are very important and that do have a lot of experience in filmmaking and have a clear...
Thank you for that. So, Dave, we're running short on time and actually getting a lot of emails asking the same question from young aspiring filmmakers. What do you tell them?
It's so difficult. That's why movies have to be special. Like since I was in film school, there's been so many, the technology is so improved that you can make movies cheaply. Unfortunately, I'm going to take the dark side here. A lot of the films are not ready to be made, and we're having a glut of films that are sort of half thought out or two-thirds there, but they're not finished. So I would urge you, it's not easy to always make a movie, which is, although you can now with an iPhone, apparently, but, you have to please think about story, narrative, make it interesting, entertaining to your public that is going to see it. Make sure they want to see it. It's just not you're expressing your, it's like writing a novel now because you can just say what you want and, everyone can access it.
You've said it's exhausting, too. I think
telling a good story takes to build the ability to tell the story.
You still love it, though.
I do. Yeah. I think it's a challenge every time you start fresh. You don't have credits. You're at zero. You have to be as fresh as a newborn baby.
Stay fresh. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Oliver Stone, again, congratulations to him for being the recipient of the San Francisco International Film Society Make That Film Festival Award, Director's Award. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to thank our whole staff. Let's thank you first, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. Thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Tina Lauberg, and our interns, Adam Hill and Suki Lewis and Katrina Schwartz and Vinnie Tong. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.